Accession number 10599, Reel 7.
Major I, English, Reel 7. You wanted to make some further points, Major, before we went further with our story.
Yes. Before the Battle of Alamein started, the order had been given, while we were in the positions, that all reserve formations, units and subunits, would carry out training. It was realised that the people in the forward defended localities probably couldn't. But my company was a reserve company of 8 DLI, and we had two incidents of interest while doing this training. We did a daylight advance, one platoon covered by another, for quite some distance in the area just behind the battalion positions. And when we had reached the far end, the most enormous sandstorm blew up. And this, I think, the locals used to call it the Kamsin, which is a hot south wind. And this stirred up the sand to such an extent that it was impossible to see more than about 3 yards in front of us. And the only way we could return to the unit area was to march by compass as if it was night, and all keep close together. And these sandstorms really had to be experienced to be believed. They were something that, of course, affected both sides. really just completely finished all operations. The second occasion was when we were practicing a night attack, and we advanced across some ground quite a long way, and as we were advancing, we were suddenly fired on, and everyone got down and lay on the sand, and our intelligence officer, Dennis Neal, went forward and shouted that we were friendly. and he came to the conclusion that the people were Greeks. And after considerable shouting and a few more shots, he managed to persuade them that we were in fact British troops and not Germans for the exercise, but they were the Greeks, good soldiers though they were a little bit like that. They were liable to shoot first and ask questions afterwards.
Were incidents like that quite prevalent?
No, they weren't really very common, but you did hear about them. They did happen.
Can we talk for a short while, Major, about the composition and structure of C Company that you took over?
Yes, well, at full strength, a rifle company, and C Company was no exception, it was about 100, slightly over 100 men, and divided into three platoons of 32 men each. We had 13 platoon, and 14 platoon, and 15 platoon. And at this time, the 13 platoon was commanded by Lieutenant Harry Welsh, who had in fact been a regular other rank and had been commissioned. The second 14 platoon was Lieutenant Freddie Bullman, and 15 platoon by a lad from Liverpool, Second Lieutenant Roberts. Now, in company headquarters, of course, in this case, Captain Ian Turnbull, who was in fact the eldest son of the Honourable the Eighth, and Company Sergeant Major Ranson, colour sergeant, of course, the company quartermaster sergeant, company clerk, storeman, company sanitary, one runner. And that was the whole company. Now, when we were on operations, of course, we didn't have everyone with us. The company quartermaster sergeant would be echelon, and probably men also. And when we were doing an operation, doing an attack, it was probable that the company headquarters would be split. Advanced company headquarters, the company commander, and his signaller from the signal platoon in headquarter company, which platoon, and one man carrying the company headquarters Bren gun. And the rear company headquarters would very often be the second in command and the company sergeant major and the remainder of company headquarters. That was pretty standard pattern.
Is it possible to describe in general terms how a company would be used in an action?
Well, this obviously depends very much on the type of operation. I mean, it's in a defensive position. The layout very much on the ground to be covered. Normally, we would hope to have probably two platoons forward and one in reserve. And one would always try to keep some reserve if possible. In a daylight attack, the formation and the method of operating would depend a little bit on the fire support. If you are operating on a time program from the gunners, well, one would keep to that. But if you were probably less organized resistance and you were advancing under your own firepower, well, then one might have one platoon up, covered by at least one of the others, and the third platoon ready to do an outflanking movement. Well, the operations which we were about to carry out in the desert, in other words, at El Alamein and indeed at Marath, were night attacks supported by tremendous artillery. And one was tied completely to the artillery program and the speed of the barrage. And at night, it was absolutely essential, of course, to keep people together. And so we would be in covering a fairly small area, with probably with two platoons up and one in reserve, but every man certainly no more than 3 or 4 yards apart. And particularly at Alamein, we found that this worked well.
What exactly was the role of a company commander?
Well, of course, a company commander, in the same way as any other commander, is responsible for everything that happens in the company. In operations, he receives the battalion commander and makes his plan according to that, and he is responsible for the company completing its task as ordered in the general battalion plan, and also using to the fullest effect any supporting arms to which he may be allotted, and generally to run the show. He has to delegate the feeding side and supply side and that sort of thing to his second in command and probably the company called Master Sound.
Out of action, there would be a certain number of routine duties which a company commander had to perform. What way were they carried out?
Well, this again would depend on what sort of situation you were in. You might be having to provide guards, you might be having to provide working parties, or mine laying parties, or anything of this sort, or indeed perhaps providing one's transport to help with some transport operation. And he would see, having had the instructions, the company commander would see that these were carried out with the resources necessary and the number of men, and not too many. And of course, out of operations, he's certainly in wartime, everyone turns their attention to training, and he's responsible that his company is fully and completely trained, if possible.
Is there a part to this as well?
Yes. The military law lays down for petty offences the company commander can deal with direct. If he thinks that it's rather more serious, it is laid down as more serious, he would be remanded for the commanding officer. But other things in the minor way we would attempt to deal with within the company, but of course these had to be reported in the normal way to battalion headquarters. So what action had been taken?
Had communications improved at this stage of the war, Major? Particularly I'm thinking of in a fluid situation.
Well, they hadn't really altered very much from France, 1940 actually. The battalion wireless net was still relying on 18 sets, which wasn't a bad set in many ways. It was quite rather heavy and carried on the back. There was no, at that time, there was no wireless between company headquarters and platoons. That didn't arrive. I don't think they had it in Sicily. I wasn't in Sicily, but it had arrived by the time we went. And so one relied on the time or methods of signals, hand signals, or runners, carrying either verbal or written messages.
The weapon situation, had there been any changes in the weapons that you were using?
No, not a lot. We obviously had, which we hadn't had earlier in the war, a full complement of the 3-inch mortars in the battalion. As far as the company was concerned, each section had its Bren gun. There was a Bren gun in company headquarters. One addition had been a company headquarters were allotted a carrier, which was useful, and jeeps, the American jeeps, were just beginning to come in for use of commanders, the CO and company commanders and signal officers and these sort of people. There was a 2-inch mortar in each platoon, which we should have had earlier on, but I think it probably hadn't arrived. Otherwise, things were much the same. There was some improvement in grenades. We were allotted a thing called a 68 grenade, which was an anti-tank grenade fired from a cup on the end of a rifle. We'd always had the old First War 36 grenades, in other words, a hand grenade which one threw.
Was the 68 grenade effective?
Yes, it was. It was quite good. It wasn't very easy to aim, we found that if it landed, you know, within a yard or two even of a tank, that in many cases was enough for the tank to shear off. It was later on when we were given a thing called a PIAT, which was a percussion grenade fired from a weapon which was held in the shoulder and had a tripod on the ground. And if we'd had those in some of the desert battles, we'd have been very much better off. But that hadn't arrived.
Had there been any additions or changes in personal weapons?
No, not really. We still had, of course, the Lee Enfield rifle, and section commanders carried the Thompson submachine gun.
How effective was that?
Very effective. It was rather heavy, but it was a very good weapon. In many ways, it was better, really, than the Sten, which replaced it, because it didn't have. It was sturdier. On the other hand, of course, it had to be carried, and the Sten was very light. I think the attention had been all the time, of course, was to get people to shoot straight.
Can we turn to German weapons, the kind of weapons that you were facing? Were there any of those which were particularly respected?
Well, they had a very good machine gun, which which was called the Spandau. Whether it originated in Berlin, I don't know. But this could be either a light machine gun, which it was most of the time, or indeed could be mounted on a tripod and act as a heavy machine gun. And they had otherwise rifles which were very comparable with ours. They had a grenade on a, with a long wooden stick grenade, which perhaps in some way throw. And that was quite a useful weapon, but I don't think really in the hands of a trained man any better than the 36 grenade. Their mortars were used very well and were very effective, and they outranged a 3-inch mortar. They didn't, to the best of my knowledge, they didn't have a 2-inch mortar in their platoons, but they had, I think, possibly rather more 3-inch mortars than we had, or some of that sort of caliber. And as I say, they had a longer range. And then, of course, the anti-tank guns. We were still mainly armed with 2-pounders. The 6-pounders were just coming in, and some of the anti-tank regiments, the Royal Artillery, were being armed with 6-pounders, which was a gun very equivalent to the 50mm German gun, but just as good, probably, if not better. But on the other hand, of course, what the tank men didn't like was we had nothing comparable to the 88mm, which was very well handled always, or an enormous gun, but they caused untold destruction in the 88. Artillery, I think, were comparable, really. The 25-pounder was probably rather better than an average German field gun, I think.
And mines, how did you cope with mines?
Yes, well, these were a constant problem. The Germans were expert at laying mines and booby traps, and their ingenuity was tremendous. In the pursuit from Alamein, which we haven't yet come to, perhaps, they really demonstrated their devilish cunning in this business, and they had very good mines. And had the Teller mine, which was an anti-tank mine with various anti-lifting devices. And then they had an anti-personnel mine, which leapt out of the ground and exploded. We relied on millions of mines made in Egypt, which were pretty good, but if they'd been in the ground for some time, were somewhat unreliable. Although I think we probably had more of them than the Germans, but I don't think that the British Army really took mines quite as seriously as the Germans, because they were They use them all the time, and they, in one or two places in the desert, they literally denied the ground completely with their minds.
And what's the only way in which you could discover these? Through using the bayonet?
Well, not quite, no. We did have, or rather the sappers had, mine detectors, which worked on the principle of the plate being passed over the ground, and when one came to a mine or a big piece of metal, then it buzzed in the air, and then you started looking. If there were no mine detectors, well, then there was nothing left for it but to for the infantry to go forward and prod the ground with bayonets, and this was done. If you were up against anti-tank mines only, it wasn't too bad, but when they were mixed with anti-personnel mines, it was just one awful job. And then later on, we got tanks armed with flails, codenamed Scorpions, which thrashed the ground and exploded the mines in front of the tank. But that wasn't introduced till the Battle of Marath.
Was it particularly dangerous? One sees the pictures of them prodding the ground with the bayonet. Was that a particularly dangerous attempt to find a mine, or did it fire them off? Or?
No, not normally. If it was an anti-tank mine, it normally required bigger pressure than that. A light truck going over it would detonate it, of course. But having found it, one then's got to lift it. And that, I think, is where the skill comes in, to put your hand underneath and this sort of thing, and feel around to make certain it's safe to be lifted.
And was the normal infantry soldier taught to do this?
Yes. Never fully enough, unfortunately. There's normally so much else for them to learn to do, and particularly when we're getting reinforcements, who in many cases required quite a lot of training. But we did do this, and particularly between Alamein and Marath, we devoted quite a time to this, but eventually one found that, of course, one or two of the men became fairly expert, and they were in many cases given the job. But the sapper support was very good, and the 505 Field Company, which is in the 151 Brigade group, they were excellent, and we normally, where we were in any sort of operation requiring sappers, we always got them.